Ringing. This meeting of House Fisheries Committee will come to order at 10:04 a.m. in room 120. Welcome, everybody. This is a small reminder. Please turn off your cell phones. Today is Tuesday, February 24th, 2015. Member present, Representative Herron, Representative Millett, Representative Ortiz, and myself, Chair Stutes. We're also joined by Kelly Burnett from House Records, Jess Hines from the LIO, and of course my fisheries aide, Reed Harris. Today we're going to have a presentation by the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission, and I would like to remind everybody that House Bill 112 or the Lawson Report will not be a topic of discussion today. We will have that discussion on Thursday, March 5th. So, presenting are our commissioners from the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission, and if you'd please identify yourself, gentlemen, and welcome.
Madam Chair, with the helpful reminder on your screen, we are the Entry Commission, and I'm Chair Bruce Twomley. And on my right is Commissioner Benjamin Brown, and my left, our newest commissioner, Vern Ruprecht. Shall we proceed?
Please proceed. Thank you.
looking at our second slide offering up there, this all began back in 1972 when the Alaskan voters approved an amendment to the Constitution to authorize limited entry. It's Article 8, Section 15. This followed a number of attempts by the state to achieve limited entry, some of which were struck down by the court. And the solution was this constitutional amendment. The operative wording in the amendment is the state can do limited entry as long as it's serving conservation and preventing economic distress among fishermen. But the Supreme Court in the Johns case has warned us that limited entry is confined to those constitutional purposes. If it gets beyond that, just to ensure the wealth of fishermen and the value of permits, we have gone too far, and at that point we have an obligation to put more permits back into the fishery to avoid a fishery becoming too exclusive. So we have the commission from the beginning has walked this constitutional tightrope. It's something that we have to observe in all of our decisions.
Excuse me for just one moment. I'd like to acknowledge Representative Christ Tompkins. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Proceed.
The passage of the amendment in 1972 was followed quickly by the legislature's action, and in one session they enacted the Limited Entry Act, which I mean, you will note if you wade through it, it's complicated. And one Supreme Court justice has referred to it as arcane. It's difficult to get into. It's a specialty. There are only a few lawyers in the state who are really good at representing fishermen before the commission. It's very much a specialty. It's kind of difficult to navigate, and we appreciate the expertise that resides in a few people who address these issues. The implementation of limited entry, really starting in about 1975 and running initially through 1980, the commission at that time did just an incredible job with much less technology than we have now. But one of the features of the Limited Entry Act, I don't think was of the operation of the Limited Entry Act may not have been entirely clear at that time. It became clear very soon, but the commission then limited the original 19 salmon fisheries all at the same time. Under the Act, they all had the qualification date of January 1, 1973, and this is a feature of limited entry that actually has caused some problems, but it's just a fact of life. 19 fisheries limited, including Bristol Bay with its thousands of fishermen, and all those applications came in at the same time. And the first stage of reviewing an application, and the object of the review is to determine who among the applicants is most dependent on a particular fishery, and then ultimately, under a point system established by the commission, then ultimately permits go to people with the most points showing the most dependence on a fishery, and then working one's way down through the point system until you hit or try to hit the maximum number. But the point I wanted to make is that initial review is pretty easy because it's a review of a paper trail. It's looking at fish tickets and who measures up according to the paper trail. Those decisions are made across the board fairly quickly in a short period of time. What happens after that is that applicants have due process rights and have the opportunity to appeal from the initial determination. And we commissioners are administrative law judges and the last level of appeal for fishermen claiming rights to participate in a fishery. But it's not an orderly case flow where cases come through the door periodically and leave periodically. The cases come in a flood. So you always start with a pile of appeals after the limitation of a fishery. So you're faced with just a flood of cases, and you have to pick and choose among them as to which cases you pick up.
Excuse me, I'd like to acknowledge Representative Foster, who's just joined us.
Madam Chair?
Go forward, please.
And there have been interruptions along the way, and one of them came early on in the form of a class action, Isaacson v. Rickey. I mentioned that the Act had a qualification date of January 1, 1973 for all of the originally limited salmon fisheries. Isaacson v. Rickey was a class action brought on behalf of individuals who had held gear licenses for the first time in 1973 and 1974. They weren't eligible, or not considered eligible, under the Act as it was first applied. But the case was successful. They crashed the system, and that allowed new applicants who had held permits for the first time, 73 and 74. This was one of the developments that caused the commission to go over the maximum number in a number of fisheries. Things were in process, maximum numbers had been set, the commission was already deciding cases, and suddenly there were there was more 1,327 new applicants to deal with. So that caused some fisheries to go over the maximum number. There are two other ways that the maximum number has been exceeded in fisheries, and they really come from the Limited Entry Act itself. The commission has to give permits to fishermen who under the point system show that they would have a significant economic hardship if they didn't receive a permit by initial issuance. And then similarly, and I'll get to this point later in a specific case, but there's another instance in which the commission has actually been ordered to go over the maximum number. And I'll get to that because I want to talk about a specific case later in this process. At the time, the commission, faced with this flood of cases, was committed to getting all the evidence down. So the commission adopted a policy of doing all the hearings first, which led to a bunch of tapes of hearings. And then they planned to write decisions based on those tapes later. But by the early 80s, the position in which the commission found itself was that there had been 500 hearings conducted by five different hearing officers, all of whom had left the commission by that time. So that meant new hearing officers came in and faced a room full of 500 tapes with new tapes coming in all the time. So I want to mention that just, I don't know what else the commission could have done.
Excuse me.
Mm-hmm. What year did the commission
say? Well, I'm sorry. This was the situation. The process began in 75, and then this was the situation that evolved in 1980 as a result of the choice made to try to get all the hearings done and write decisions later.
So what I understood you to say was they just recorded the hearings on tapes and put them aside to adjudicate them later?
Yes, because this wasn't our call. I was nowhere near the commission. I was representing fishermen before the commission at this time, actually.
Right.
But yeah, that was a choice that was made. And all the choices would have presented some difficult prospects, but this did indeed. I mean, this was the fact of life.
Okay, thank you.
30 years ago.
Right.
Now, in the 80s, the commission, I'm sorry? Oh.
No, George.
In the 80s, the commission began to feel the effects of some Supreme Court cases. And the principal case was the Ostrowski case in 1983. Bob Wagstaff brought a case on behalf of Hank Ostrowski from Bristol Bay. And what they wanted out of the case was to strike down free transferability of limited entry permits. That was the object of the case. But some people had the view, and evidently some people on the Supreme Court had the view, that this case could be the vehicle to take out limited entry entirely. And for that reason, the Supreme Court held all of the other limited entry cases in abeyance until they decided Ostrowski in 1983. And Ostrowski was significant because they upheld free transferability. And one of the primary reasons they did it was the legislature's declaration that free transferability of limited entry permits gives individual permit holders the power to preserve those permits for families and partners and other members of communities who need access to their traditional fisheries. That was very important to the Supreme Court, and it's been important to us in administering the act. It's a power that we've tried to encourage people to use for the good, and we've supported programs that would help people do that. But the notion is that was the means of keeping permits in the hands of Alaskans and Alaskan families. Where that led, of course, was that in the 2 years that followed Ostrowski, now that we're going forward with other cases, they issued 28 limited entry decisions in 2 years, and that's really a record. That's quite a deluge. And among those cases were some very significant cases, and we've listed them for you there, and I'm not going to slog through those cases. There are two I want to emphasize, but I'm not going to deal with particular cases unless somebody has an interest in one of them. But the cases I wanted to highlight, and this comes up on the next slide, are the Bahia Yuk and Cashin case, because these are two cases we've had to be conscious of with every decision that we have issued. The Bahia Yuk case held that when the Supreme Court reverses a rule of the commission, that reversal can be applied retroactively to reopen previously closed cases in a fishery. And then the Cashin case came along and said, on the same premise, that we were also required to allow new applications long after the application period from people who had not applied before. This represents, well, it's a threat that has hung over the commission with every decision we've ever issued. It means that the commission doesn't have a margin for error in its decisions. It means that we have never been in a position where we could sacrifice quality for quantity. We always had to give our best effort on every decision in an attempt to ensure that it wasn't going to be overruled by the Supreme Court. Now, this is still with us today, and I'm going to touch on that probably at the end of this presentation. But the Wassily settlement came along in 1988. That was another class action. It was to allow people to apply who had been disadvantaged in the initial application process, primarily rural people. But it was settled. I didn't participate in the settlement. I had to disqualify myself, but my two co-commissioners did pursue this settlement. I do want to say something self-serving while we're at this. You know, I told you about the cases that had an impact on the system. I came along late. I had no part in any of those decisions that were reversed by the Supreme Court at that time. But I did come along in time. Governor Hammond appointed me on Halloween of 1982, and so I got there just in time to inherit the results of those cases. And I had to work with my co-commissioners on implementing them. What I wanted to point out about the Wassily settlement is that part of the settlement was that the applicants eligible under Wassily did not get to fish until and unless the commission gave them a favorable decision. So the immediate right to fish was at stake in all of those cases, and the immediate right to fish is at stake in all of our transfer cases. And consequently, we gave Wassily priority over all other cases. We give transfer cases priority over all other cases. And that's in contrast to applications for permanent entry permits, because where there's an application for a permanent entry permit, that individual can continue to fish as long as the individual can keep an application alive. And Bruce Weirich has noted before the legislature in testimony that that's the game. If you could keep an application going, your client gets to fish indefinitely. The Supreme Court has termed that a windfall, but that too is written into the Act. Now, the other aggravating factor, although I mean there are benefits to this, but the under the Act, the Commission has an affirmative duty to limit a fishery when the case is made to us, basically under the Constitution, but there are terms of the Act, but it all comes down to the constitutional authorization. When it can be demonstrated to the Commission that limiting entry to a fishery will serve conservation and prevent economic distress among fishermen, at that point we've got an affirmative duty to go forward. We don't have discretion. We can't turn our backs on that. So consequently, since 1984, the Commission had an affirmative duty to limit an additional 35 fisheries, bringing in some 4,700 applications. So the Commission is a moving bus. Some people get to get off, but there are always other people getting on, and that's been the process from the inception. Where that led was by 1990, the Commission's caseload had almost doubled, and we had some nearly 900 cases before us, which I have to say was unmanageable. We had to, at that point, select cases by triage just to figure out how to work our way through this pile of cases. And what we chose in terms of applications, we chose the fisheries that at the time were under the most pressure. And so we had Prince William Sound fisheries by virtue of the 1989 Exxon Valdez oil spill. We also chose Cook Inlet salmon, drift, and set because those commercial fisheries were already under pressure from the Board of Fish. The Board was already limiting some of their opportunities and has continued to do so. And we also chose Southeast salmon seine and troll, because they were being limited by the U.S.-Canada treaty that was in place. So those, among applications, those were our priorities. At that time, and this is a situation that changed pretty quickly, but at that time, there was less pressure on Chignik, for example. Chignik at the time looked like one of the most successful salmon fisheries in the state. We were a little concerned someone might accuse it of being too exclusive. But at that moment, we got a petition from residents of the three Chignik communities asking us to put off adjudicating, to stop issuing cases in Chignik because they wanted to keep those people in the fishery. Now, we have a duty to go forward. We can't ignore the duty, but that was certainly encouragement to look at fisheries under more pressure at the time. So we did that. Similarly, in Bristol Bay Drift, We had denied an attorney from Anchorage named Kelly, denied his application, and so he went to court and sued the state, and his claim was that the Bristol Bay drift fishery had become so healthy and so wealthy that limited entry could be erased entirely for the drift fishery. It simply wasn't needed by virtue of changed circumstances. And we had to take that claim very seriously, but we also had to note that things did look good in Bristol Bay. I mean, their permit prices were going through the ceiling in 1990. It looked like a good place to fish, a valuable place to fish. And so we put Bristol Bay aside while we did fisheries that were under more pressure. And we focused on the fisheries that I identified that looked more pressured. To mention briefly our overall priorities, anytime a case has a right to fish at stake, the immediate right to fish, that's a top priority. Applies to Wassily, applies to transfer cases. And, of course, for the applications for permit and entry permits, we took the fisheries that looked like they were under the most pressure at a given time. But the world got upended by 1997. By 1997, it was clear that farm salmon was competing vigorously and undermining the markets for wild salmon, and that began the salmon collapse at that time. It was a world change, and from that point forward, all the salmon fisheries were in deep trouble. Economists can talk about this at length, but that meant that we had to reorder things, and we turned our attention to Bristol Bay because that's the largest salmon fishery and it affected the most people. Now, from the 1980s through 2005, we faced other obstacles. And actually, a big one was the IRS in their efforts to seize and force the sale of limited entry permits. Now, that's contrary to state law. I mean, the legislature made clear that limited entry permits are privileges, and the legislature has the right to modify them or revoke them without compensation. They're also, legislature intended that they remain available to the individuals who held them because, it's simply necessary to support families, and the legislature declared them exempt from the claims of most creditors. In fact, all creditors to begin with, but that got encroached on a little bit. So when the IRS began going after limited entry permits, attempting to seize and force their sale, we spent more than 10 years resisting the IRS efforts. I can tell you there was one instance where the IRS agents came to our counter at the Limited Entry Commission. They called for me by name, and they came out and presented papers to seize a permit and asked me to read a couple of paragraphs from the papers, and I refused. And so they read the paragraphs to me out loud, and what they declared was, if you interfere with an IRS levy, you can be held personally liable on the underlying tax obligation, and then on top of that, you can be convicted of a felony. And so I listened to them, and when they finally left, I took the papers, ran back, and called our AG up in Anchorage, John Baker, and he was something of a comedian. He wanted to know, is this your one free call? So that was the support I had at the time. Nonetheless, we got to a point where IRS conducted a massive sale, demanded that we pass, that we transfer a permit, and this was an IRS agent appearing before us and signing all the paperwork. We refused in the Carl decision. And that was 1996. We had considerable support at that time, but I want to mention that the commission is an independent agency, and so we made the decision to resist the IRS. We haven't been supported in that decision by every AG. And I remember during the Cooper administration, there was an AG who was kind of resisting the notion of us confronting the IRS. And I had a co-commissioner who arranged for me to sit at a luncheon next to Steve Cooper. And I raised this topic with Steve Cooper. What do we do? We would like to resist the IRS. What do we do? And Governor Cooper's suggestion was, well, why don't you just refuse to do the transfers? And so I said, Governor, that's exactly what we'd like to do under the law. I just want to be sure that we have your support and the support of your Attorney General. And he said, oh, yeah, no question about that. So I got to go home and call Denby Lloyd in the governor's office and say that the governor just announced a policy. And that became state policy for the years that followed, and we had excellent support on this issue. But I think it points to the importance of Limited Entry Commission as an independent agency. We were able to pursue this issue because we had the authority to do it, and we were not subject to any particular political agenda. We could take this on and pursue it and take it where it went. Also, because of the collapse of the salmon fisheries, Gunnernap was kind of pushing me to write something about buyback. But buyback isn't really an exclusive remedy for fisheries that are overcrowded. I wrote instead an outline of options for fleet consolidation in Alaska's salmon fisheries, 1998, because people had presented us with a number of options right beside buyback, some of which were simpler. I mean, for example, someone holding two permits and getting to fish an incremental amount of additional gear, or things that could happen with two permits on the same vessel. There were ways that didn't require as much of a commitment as a buyback, didn't require as much of an investment as buyback, and allowed fishermen.
Excuse me. Representative.
Thank you. So I actually have a question about buybacks. So you wrote a piece saying that buybacks were not the most effective way to organize a fishery or.
But I did. In the outline, buyback was the first thing that I talked about. I pointed out some issues and some difficulties with buyback, and then I did that with every alternative. And so we ended up.
And follow up. And what year was that? 1998, you said?
1998, yes.
Follow up?
Yes.
So since then, we've actually done some fisheries buyback with permits in Southeast. I actually carried the legislation for the Saners in Southeast, and it seems to be actually a pretty good way for fisheries to manage themselves with a pool of fishermen within a group, within a region, buying back. I think we had federal money that started the program, and since then it's been working really well and put a cap on how many fish, you know, how many permits you could buy back. And so it seems to be a good way to manage internally the fishery. So do you think that, I mean, so now we probably have, that was 6 years ago, we have 6 years of data on that Southeast Saner fishery buyback. It seems to be a productive fishery and managed rather well through that process.
Oh, through the chair, Representative Millett. I agree, and we supported that program completely. We worked hand in glove with the Saners, and we came before you and other legislators to achieve a couple of pieces of legislation to make it work. I participated in the hearings with Alaska fishermen who had a lot of questions, just to try to make sure they had good information going into the vote. But one key was the fishermen got to vote. That's an important element of it. And they voted to obligate themselves under the federal loan. The other key was the Saners had to commit more than 10 years to get the feds to authorize the money for that program. It was an ordeal for them. And so it was not an easy program to put in place. Money has always been the issue. But I was personally delighted they went forward, because that's our lab study. I mean, that is what we can look at to try to evaluate buyback. And so I'm very pleased.
I'd like to take a moment to recognize Representative Edgemond, who's joined us.
So, follow-up. So, going forward, I think there's some that stimulated interest from other fisheries to look at that. There's a lot of latent permits out there. I fished in Bristol Bay. I know that we have permit stacking now, but there's also opportunities in some other fisheries that have latent permits to form the same type of fisheries group that we did with the Southeast Saners, and basically tax themselves to manage their fishery as the fishing region sees fit. Do you to support that type of management within our commercial fishing?
Well, through the chair, Representative Millett. Yes, there's an initial hurdle to every buyback program, and I think you would share the view that for a buyback program to work, there's got to be a large initial investment so that those who remain after the buyback actually can see the benefits that will help them repay the loans they've undertaken. And so there's no provision under state law to actually raise that kind of money or commit that kind of money. If the feds are prepared to do it, and there's some conversations going on right now. We met with a number of Bristol Bay fishermen at Fish Expo in Seattle just this last November. But that's the hurdle. If the money is there to make the initial purchases, that's really the key, I think, to making it work.
Mm-hmm. Follow up. And also the self-imposed tax to purchase, to purchase the permits and then to pay back the loan guarantee. Mm-hmm. I think that there's a few components, but it's not impossible. I mean, it's a good management tool to have.
I would agree.
Madam Chairman, if I may, Benjamin Brown, Commercial Fisheries Energy Commission, to respond to Representative Millett further. Fortuitously, our research staff are just putting the finishing touches on a storybook, a history of the Southeast buyback, and it'll speak to all the long work that went into arranging the federal financing for that, which is a lot more work. Now it's somewhat taken for granted. Oh, there's still almost $10 million out there to do one more round. Well, to get that $23 million authorization initially took a tremendous amount of work. Sorry, Kelly. And then, so I think once we get that report out there, that will be good reading for all members of the legislature to see what role CFEC can play in buyback schemes as they are advanced, but also looking at the different aspects of different fisheries around the state, because the differences from Bristol Bay, certainly to Cook Inlet, and then down here to Southeast, make a one-size-fits-all approach obviously impossible, but it also maybe lays a path for how to make it work and how to adapt to the differences in a different place geographically, where the different kind of gear being used creates different pressures and different problems that need to be solved through the relinquishment of permits.
Thank you, Bob. And I understand that, but I also want to acknowledge that there was a lot of fishermen that actually worked really hard to get that loan guarantee in place. It wasn't just the state working on it. It was, I think that it takes more than just the state being the avenue to get the feds to, I mean, I worked 2 years on that piece of legislation and understand the difficulties of getting that loan guarantee and keeping it. And so I think it's an incredible program. I'm not sure that it needs to be managed under your direction. I think that a lot of our commercial fishing entities have the ability to do exactly that with their own through their own volition. But I agree that you were a very good advocate for them.
Madam Chair, Representative Millett, We're not advocating that we need to be the ones running a buyback program, and we were delighted that the Sainers committed more than a decade and that you committed your time. Where we come into it is we have to share information with fishermen who are considering the buyback program, and then ultimately, more importantly, we're the ones who have to relinquish the permit, and that's a process where we have to work closely with the folks doing it to make sure that that actually gets done in a way that will be permanent and put the permits aside. So we were engaged with the Sainers and with the federal CRATs who run the program as that went forward. And we're prepared to do that in any buyback program. But no, we don't have any proprietary interest in doing a buyback program ourselves. It's possible under state law, if people came to us, we wouldn't shrink from the responsibility. But so far, I think people are wisely looking to the feds because the feds are probably the best source of the upfront money.
So my understanding of your involvement is basically you just release the fish ticket information to the federal government. I mean, that yours just your information gatherer, and then you release through that piece of legislation, from what I recall, is that you're one of the sticking points. Jerry, I don't know if you remember this, but one of the sticking points was that transfer of information, of permit documentation, mm-hmm. permit, you know, basically all the information you gather on a fish ticket to the federal government so they could make sure that the loan was going to be... they were getting an asset for the amount loaned.
Madam Chair, through the Chair, Representative Millett, that was one element. Our other involvement was to advocate for legislation that would provide a kind of insurance for the people engaged in a buyback program. I mean, we have an obligation, and this comes up under the constitutional amendment. We have an obligation to ensure that fisheries don't get too exclusive, and so it's a question that comes up really almost any time you're thinking about buyback. What we, at the request of the Sainers, we lobbied together with the Sainers for legislation that would provide a kind of insurance. And it's if a fisherman's organization were to take on an obligation and invest in a buyback program, it's basically legislation that parallels the aquaculture associations. And so If fishermen invest in a buyback program, begin paying a loan back to the feds, for example, and then if people come to us claiming the fisheries become too exclusive, and if we have to make an optimum number determination, as we have a duty to do under the Act, and if that optimum number determination were to yield an optimum number or an optimum number range greater than the number of permits after buyback, our obligation is to sell more permits to make the fishery constitutional. And now, clearly that's a disappointment disruptive to the people with hopes and buyback. But what the legislation does is provide, authorize the legislature to appropriate the money that we get from the sale of permits to reimburse the fishermen's organization or to help retire the loan that they've undertaken.
One last follow-up. So from what I recall, we actually put limits on it in the legislation. There was an up to level of permit buyback. I mean, you made that determination in the Southeast Saners legislation, and that was one determination for one fishery that I think we set a limit, no more than 32 permits a year and up to, I think, 10% of the total amount of permits. And so, I mean that limitation is in statute, and the Southeast fishery stays whole.
Through the chair, Representative Millett, we did not make that determination. And it's in a letter of intent as part of the legislative history, but it was negotiated between the Saners and processors who wanted a limit on it. They insisted on a limit. Because, of course, there's competition for fishermen, and the less competition, the better from the standpoint of a processor. So that's where we got that lower limit.
Okay. Representative Ortiz?
Follow up a little bit more on the constitutional mandate to make sure that a particular fishery doesn't get too exclusive. Is that a subjective decision on either your part or some other body's part as to when it's becoming too exclusive, or is it a numbers-based decision? How does that work?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, it involves as little subjectivity as we can manage. We've done three optimum number studies, and what we really have to do is apply the terms of the constitutional amendment. Can we demonstrate that the fishery is serving conservation, and is it preventing economic distress among fishermen? It happened that we were challenged. Well, we did an elaborate. The normal way to approach it is to do an elaborate economic study, and we did that for Bristol Bay, and Gunnar Knapp actually made some estimates of what future salmon prices were going to be for the bay, and based on his estimates, some models were developed. And another foundation for developing the models was that our staff interviewed a number of fishermen and looked at their tax returns, because you have to determine, it's a rare situation where you have to intrude to that extent to figure out what kind of profits people are making, net returns. An awful lot of data went into that. And we were helped by the legislature, too, because looking at the Bristol Bay fishery, thousands of fishermen, and an act that originally said you got to pick the number that's just right for the two salmon fisheries in Bristol Bay. That's kind of that's a small target. It's kind of like Robin Hood shooting through the arrow that's already lodged in the bullseye. And we thought that was kind of tough. And so the legislature helped us by declaring that the optimum number could be a range of numbers, not just one number that was just right and represented a bullseye. So they gave us that, and we're grateful. And we were able to employ an optimum number range in doing the optimum number for Bristol Bay. But let me do a contrast. The difficulty with a study like that is, in this case, I think it took 2 years, very expensive, very intrusive, but we got an optimum number that hasn't been challenged. The only thing is that the world has changed since then, and Gunnar is the first one to admit that all of his assumptions made early in this century, during the salmon crisis, all of his assumptions were wrong, because world markets have improved so much since then. So I think the methodology was good for that study, but the premise and consequently the conclusions are out of date at this point. But let me give you a contrast. We were challenged in the northern southeast inside sablefish fishery, and the claim was put before us that we should stop adjudicating permits because the fishery was it was too exclusive or was going to be too exclusive. It was basically by denied applicants who brought the claim. And so we did an optimum number study, and we had, in the course of, well, we, sorry, what happened was we had really strong testimony from the managers, the manager, and from an earlier commissioner, Commissioner Collinsworth, and then Tory O'Connell. And what they upheld strongly was that low numbers were needed in order to serve conservation, in order to conserve the fishery and go forward. So with that testimony, I wrote an optimum number rationale without any benefit of a study, and it was challenged by folks in court, and it was upheld. So we think that this whole process might be able to be more compact. We think that one might be able to go forward without doing a full-blown optimum number study, but it requires careful attention to the constitutional premises, and if you've got data and testimony to show that you're serving those premises and not getting beyond the constitutional purposes, I think we want to, on behalf of fishermen who want to protect their fisheries and maybe go forward with a buyback program, I think Vern has suggested we probably want to push the envelope and see if we can't do that again. It's simpler, and but it's not a subjective call. You need a very solid record, and you really need managers to point out that the numbers you're looking at are really necessary for the sake of conservation. And when we were talking to when we were meeting with fishermen talking about optimum numbers down in Seattle last fall, and talking about Bristol Bay, there really was good testimony from the managers there. They were pointing out that their needs in order to manage the fishery, and so it's possible to get some good testimony, and the court agreed with us, and this was the premise for our rationale, that it's axiomatic you got to have conservation. That's the starting point. So if you can demonstrate conservation, you can probably cover the rest without too much trouble.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
The other interruption that we faced starting in 1984 was the Carlson class action, and you may know that as it was an action by out-of-state fishermen who wanted to strike down the 3-to-1 fee differential that we charged for limited entry permits under regulation and later under statute, and they succeeded in striking down the 3-to-1 fee differential as being discriminatory and violative of the Privileges and Immunities Clause of the Constitution. The court then imposed a formula that we administer to determine what the fair share is of non-residents. But I mention it because the state spent a great deal of time defending this. They needed us, of course, to help defend it. And it was a class action that started in 1984. We were still receiving requests for hearings in 2014. The curious thing about the class action was the class represented some 95,000 people, but out of the class, only 4,700 of them recovered damages under calculations that the commission made and that the court accepted. But the individuals were given a right to appeal to us if they were unhappy with not getting a reward or not getting enough money. And that left the possibility of us facing 90,000 hearing requests. Happy to report that didn't happen, but we also went to tremendous lengths in the agency and committed all of our adjudication staff to trying to answer people's questions in an attempt to deflect hearings. And we were able to deflect a number of hearings, and I'm happy to report that we concluded the hearing process last year, 2014. And so on our end of things, we think it's over unless somebody appeals and something further happens in court. But we've done our end of that. But it leads me to another comparison. I mean, I've been engaged in class actions. I used to represent plaintiffs back when I was suing the state for a living. And then in the Carlson, I was a recipient of a class action. I was a respondent to this class action. And I just want to contrast those efforts and Carlson, which went on for 30 years, to the Limited Entry Commission. I mean, I can say with some experience that the volume and the complexity of the work before the commission is greater. It's more labor-intensive. You know, you have point systems that vary from fishery to fishery. The adjudications are fact-intensive for each individual who's in front of you. I mean, I think that the time required to do adjudications at the commission has been a result of this volume and complexity, and is, I think, at least as difficult, but I would contend more difficult than the Carlson class action, for example. We also, in terms of obstacles, we face some budget cuts over the years. And early in our experience, we eliminated our executive director, and the commissioners, in addition to being administrative law judges, took on the responsibility of managing the agency. And we have been doing that ever since. We have also been benefited by virtue of being an exempt agency. So when we faced budget cuts over the years, we could do things that other agencies subject to the Personnel Act can't do. We've been able to freeze salaries, for example. We have, there was a period when more often than not, we froze all employees' salaries. It got to be 2008 before we were actually able to restore all the salaries, and since then we haven't had to. But we have that flexibility to meet budget cuts. We, in fact, we once received a mid-year budget cut, and we absorbed it by administering graduated reductions in hours and salaries, starting with 12% at the commissioner level, and then lowering the cut all the way down to our lowest paid workers. And so we've had that flexibility. But I just want to point out that over the years, we have paid some dues, because in 1986 we had 41 full-time authorized positions, and today we have 28. It's a reduction of more than 30%. And the feature of receiving cuts like that is that the folks who remain have to absorb all those responsibilities of the positions that have been lost.
Representative Millett.
So that budget cut came in what year?
This was over time, and it started in the early 80s, and it is, we've been at 28 for a few years now.
So how many cases have you adjudicated since it stops? My chart stops at 2011. So between 2011 and 2013, how many cases are you adjudicating now currently?
Well, in 2014, we adjudicated. I got a cheat sheet, but in 2014. We adjudicated, I believe, 143 cases.
And how many of those were on appeal?
Of those cases, none so far. The time's still running on some of them.
And how about in 2013, how many, so just, can you structurally just go back from 2011 to 2000 to today, how many appeal, how many cases have you had to have gone into appeal?
I don't have figures for 2013 handy, but I can get them for you. But 2014, let me refer to my cheat sheet. Yeah, we adjudicated 143 cases in 2014.
143.
143.
Thank you.
Okay.
Proceed,
please.
Yeah. And so, I mean, after having faced 900 cases, almost 900 cases, and having to do triage back in 1990, we are finally at the point of having achieved a caseload that is rational and manageable. And we are committed to working our way through that caseload in 2016. And one has to make allowances for appeals and remands that could follow that. But that's our goal. That's what we want to pursue. And we also, I mean, continue to make transfer cases a priority. And we attached one transfer case. Well, we have a transfer case we can make available to you. And it's the Williams case, and it was a case that was just decided at the beginning of this year, but It was a very compelling situation. I think it helps demonstrate that transfer cases can be as serious and as complicated as any application for a permit. It was an individual from a village, an elderly woman who almost lost $40,000 of her life savings in the course of a transfer that went bad because the transferor refused to do the transfer after the money had been paid over. And we commissioners intervened, took control of the case, and we were able to devise a remedy that ultimately we required the permit to be transferred. And so I would like that to be available just as an example that transfer cases cannot be dismissed as minimal. The stakes can be very high, and I think the complications of this case can be perceived by any reader.
Can I ask you a question?
Oh, Representative Millett, please.
Can you just walk us through, like, just the timeline and time that your office pays with just give me a simple permit application, and how long does that take to process? Like, what is the detail of a permit process? Just a simple one. Complicated one.
Yeah. And are we talking about applications or transfers?
Yeah, application.
Okay. There's a limitation. There's an adoption of a point system. Then fishermen apply for a permit under the point system, make an application. And then there's an initial review by paralegals. And that's pretty much a paper search. It's the paralegal determining whether or not there are fish tickets to support the claims. And at that point, they'll be denying and granting some permits based on the paper trail. Then the applicants have an opportunity to appeal to a hearing officer.
So, follow up?
Please.
So what are some of the reasons a permit application would be denied when you say there's a paper process? Is it credit history? What is just time in the state or previous fishing experience?
We have to devise a point system that measures individuals' dependence on the fishery they're applying for. And so past participation is an element. People with more past participation score better on the point system. And then economic dependence is an element, too. People who can show greater economic dependence on that fishery get more points. So they have to prove up points under the point system. Some claims are denied because they failed. The fish tickets don't support the claim. Or if they succeed, then they get the points.
So follow up.
Please.
So someone new to Alaska that has zero fishing experience but wants to get into the fishery starts out with 0 points?
Well,
On that marker?
Sure. If they happen to show up at that point, and to be eligible, they would have had to have fished with a gear license or interim use permit before the qualification date for the fishery. A deckhand, if they hadn't had an interim use permit of the fishery, would not be eligible to apply. I should mention the initial decision to limit a fishery is the decision to call out a maximum number. And by law, the maximum number has to be the highest number of units of gear in one of the 4 years leading up to the limitation. So that's where the maximum number comes in, and that's what we're shooting for, of course, in the adjudication process, trying to hit that as close as possible.
A follow-up? So if they don't meet that criteria and their application is rejected, then they go into the appeal process of coming up with further documentation to support?
That's true.
Okay. And can you walk me through that process really quick?
Sure. They would appeal first to a hearing officer. Hearing officer would conduct a hearing for their benefit. Sometimes the record remains open so that they can track other additional evidence. Ultimately, the hearing officer issues a decision, and that could be to issue the permit. However, if they're unhappy with the decision, that's where we come in. We're the last level of appeal in the agency. And if they're unhappy with us, they go to court.
And so up to that point where you get involved, is that part of the 143 permits that you process that you're talking about over the last couple of years?
That's true.
Okay. Along that same line, if I come in with my application, what is the time frame for you to determine whether or not I'm eligible?
Today, well, Well, for example, if we have an application for a transfer, and an individual needs the transfer, of course, to participate in the fishery, if there's a denial by licensing staff, they get a hearing, and that's a hearing that we can turn around in days, 2 days, to give that individual an answer. And if they're unhappy with paralegal, they get another shot through the hearing officer, and they get another shot through us. And we make those cases the top priority. We turn them around in days. I think we can beat any other agency on those cases where the right to fish is at stake, the immediate right to fish. That's what's important, because otherwise they would lose fishing time.
So are you talking about transfers? No. Like a transfer between NACNIC and IGIIC? If I want to, I have a 24-hour waiting period, are you talking about those transfers?
No, I'm not.
Okay.
I'm talking about when an individual wants to transfer a permit to another, someone wants to buy a permit and get the permit in hand so they can fish.
Oh.
If that's turned down.
Son to a father, father to a son.
Representative Millett?
Sorry. Mm-hmm. Son to a father, father to a son. That's what you're talking about, basically.
To Chair, Representative Millett, yes.
Okay. Question?
Representative Millett?
So how many new applications, new permit applications do you have on a yearly basis?
Through the Chair, Representative Millett. We're at the point of closing out fisheries. And so at this point, we're not getting new applications. We're looking at applications before us. It would take a limitation to generate new applications.
How many new permit applications do you process in 1 year? Any given year? 2014, how many new permits did you process? Not transfers, not adjudicate, new permit applications.
Oh, we have in the last, well, looking back over the last year, we at our end concluded 3 permit transfers. We issued final decisions in 3 permit transfers, but they had come up through the system to reach us.
Representative Millett?
I'm good. I'll write out my questions. I don't think he understands what I'm asking.
Okay. I think the question was how many new permits were applied for in 2014, how many did you process that were not existing permits, so to speak?
Madam Chair, there were no new applications in 2014.
Okay.
We're at the point of closing out fisheries. We have this caseload before us, and so I can give you an example of how it works. And if I may,
I don't believe that's necessary. Was mm-hmm. that your question, Representative Millett?
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Proceed, please.
I can just very quickly, Madam Chairman.
The one thing that Chairman Trauma didn't mention that adds to the complexity of closing out these somewhat time-worn applications for new permits and these fisheries we're trying to finally adjudicate, it isn't just that you can prove your past participation or your relative economic dependence, but then there's also the extraordinary or unavoidable circumstances component, and that's where a fisherman would have caught the fish but for, and in my experience, and it's only 4 years on the commission, which is not a great deal in comparison to Chairman Twomley, that's been some of the most difficult part, to look back to an old record, you know, a hearing that happened long ago, and whether or not the fisherman was able to say validly, I would have fished but for, and how to look at a paper record and believe that. And that's one thing that has added to the complexity of closing out some of these time-worn final adjudications, is whether or not someone is entitled to extraordinary circumstances. And it's very ripe for appeal to the judicial branch. And so that's I just wanted to point out, because that wasn't mentioned as part of that adjudication process.
Okay. Just one more. And along those lines, then how many cases did you close out in 2014? For my own clarity,
two in 2014, and we did one right after that. So three really in the last 12 months.
Two in 2014. One in 2015.
Yeah, so far.
Oh. Thank you. Representative Millett.
So you have 60 left to do, was that correct? About 60?
Through the chair, Representative Millett, 28.
So you have 28 left to do.
We do.
And you're going to finish those in 2016?
That's our goal.
Thank you. Proceed.
And Madam Chair, with one qualification, we can get the cases done. There will undoubtedly be appeals from that, and so we have to stand ready for appeals and remands, which we get on occasion. So In terms of other things, other undertakings that get in the way of some of our adjudication responsibilities, we have something today that is actually comparable to the IRS. There's a case called the Quality One case, and the Quality One case is on the East Coast, but it held that a maritime lien could be applied to take a limited entry fishing permit. It happened to be a vessel permit in that case. But lawyers quickly picked up on the idea and have tried to apply that claim here. I mean, the reason that presents a problem is maritime liens come in ahead of all other liens. So in Bristol Bay, for example, someone could do an emergency transfer, and the emergency transferee could have bought fuel, not paid the fuel bill, and a maritime lien could come in, and conceivably, individual could take that permit out of the hands of the emergency transferee. Similarly, we have two state-authorized loan programs for which limited entry permits and IFQ are security for their loans. And the state loan program has already faced a claim that a maritime lien should apply and defeat the security of the loan program. So this is it's a big deal. And for some years we have lobbied federally and a couple of times we've gotten legislation introduced to make it clear that limited entry permits, IFQ permits, are not subject to maritime liens. We had some trouble last year. We'd gone 2 years with two commissioners. We found ourselves spread a little thin, so we did not have the opportunity to pursue it last year in 2014. But I'm kind of encouraged by the fact that Ephraim Frelick is now employed as the fish person for our senator back in D.C., and so we expect we can be able to pick this up and pursue it forward. And then I wanted to mention briefly some things about our revenue, and there are two slides that apply to this. But basically, fishermen pay for our services, and they pay more than it costs to operate our agency. And the colors don't come through on the screen, but basically when you see the shorter bar, that's what we are costing, and then the longer bar represents the revenues over and above our costs. Our costs are paid, and then we also pay money over to the Fisherman's Fund, and then the remainder, the theory is that it goes to Department of Fish and Game to apply to commercial fishing management issues. And then the second graph shows that, and this is the line graph, it shows that we generally, as an agency, spend less. We save some money, we spend less than the money appropriated to us. And that, of course, represents a savings. But on the theme of savings, I think the ultimate saving is to win the appeal cases that go to court. And that's what this slide represents. From 1996 to the present, we prevailed in 21 out of 23 Supreme Court cases. The little green bars depict the two cases that we lost, and those weren't complete losses. Those were only partial reversals, but we reported them as complete losses just to make the percentages as pure as we could. But it is efficient and economical to win cases. You can lose a lot of money pretty quickly if a case is reversed and you have to absorb the relief from the case, and then particularly with the threat of Bayayuk and Cashin over us, if that case were to be applied retroactively to undo a fishery that was already limited, I mean, the results would be enormous. So I think this is where we can continue to contribute savings to the state by avoiding any serious losses, and we have been doing that. Our success rate over this period, and it's approaching 20 years now, is greater than 90% in the Supreme Court. And then this does bring me to closing out fisheries and deciding cases. And a case that we put in front of you just today is the Koosman case. And the Koosman case involves two applicants. We faced some tough issues under a Supreme Court case. We had to wend our way through them. But we denied two applicants, and the applicants chose not to appeal. Where that left us was we had 13 other applications pending in this limited fishery. And 13, and to get to the maximum number in the fishery, we only had four places to get to the maximum number. So normally our act would have pushed us into a lottery situation where only four of those 13 would have gotten their permit by luck of the draw. However, the legislature gave us a gift, and the legislature made it a duty whenever you got into the situation where you had more applicants at a point level where you were going to grant permits. If you could grant permits to all of those applicants without going over the maximum number by more than 5% or more than 10 permits, then we have a duty to issue all the permits to everyone. So under the direction from the legislature, for which we are grateful, we were able to issue permits to the 13 winners and close out this fishery. So it's a situation where, and this kind of thing is going to happen in most of the cases before us, by deciding two cases, we were able to close out a fishery and dispose of an additional 13 people whose decisions we made long ago, but they were stuck under the system. They were stuck sitting there waiting until these other cases got resolved before their fate could be determined. So we got lucky in that case. But we're at the end of the process. We can close out more fisheries, but that makes this just a very critical stage for the commission. This would be the worst of all possible times to suffer a severe reversal and have it applied retroactively. That would undo a tremendous amount of work and disappoint a number of Alaskans depending on the particular fishery. And so it's with that in mind, we do want to ask for you to consider continuing the current organization of the fishery until we can get through our current caseloads and make those decisions final. If you think about, I mean, we're already operating under cases where if a court reverses a rule applied to the commission, then that ruling can be applied retroactively. If one were to change all the rules and one were to change the structure of the adjudications, you would have two classes in the same fishery. The individuals have been denied on either side of this divide. And the real premise for Bayayuk and Cashin is once you're within a limited fishery, you really have to treat all the people alike under the same rules. You don't want to be, if you're going to change the rules, you've got to give that change, the benefit of that change, to the people who've been previously denied. So if there were a substantial change in the structure and the rules of the commission at this time, you would end up with two classes of applicants, and denied applicants on both sides of this divide would be pointing to people on the other side of the divide saying, that individual got a better deal than I did, and I want you, court, to make this right by giving me another chance at a permit. And so that's the situation we're asking you to please avoid. And if we could continue with the same structure until we can make the current cases final, that would be our recommendation.
Do we have any questions for the commission? Reverend Christ Tompkins?
Commissioner Tompkins, could you outline the duties of the commission? I mean, for instance, there's the adjudicatory duties. You've mentioned a research division that provides data to myself or the Board of Fish or other bodies. What are other significant roles, if any, that the CFEC plays?
Okay, we're administrative law judges. Combined with that, we are rulemakers. We're the ones who adopt regulations to keep things going for the commission. And that's a real virtue. We are probably the only adjudicative body that's set up in that way. And what that means in practice is if an individual argues to us that one of our regulations is unconstitutional or unfair, we can consider that claim and we can change the reg and we have done it. That's not something the Office of Administrative Appeals can do. They're stuck with the regulations that come in front of them. But we have that discretion, that flexibility. So we can help Alaskans faced with some of those issues. So we have adjudications, we've got rulemaking, and then we are having, from the time that we dispensed with our executive director, we became managers. So we supervise. We do personnel evaluations. We do all the things that managers do.
I guess the CFEC as a whole, so thank you, Madam Chair, not just you three, but CFEC as a whole. I mean, I realize that you three don't directly endeavor in research, but if there are divisions within CFEC,
oh,
you're
sure.
Responsible for certain roles.
Sure, I mean, there are four parts to CFEC, and there's adjudications, licensing, and research and data processing. That's really it. Data processing is kind of the foundation for what we do.
Any other questions? Representative Ortiz?
Briefly, if you can summarize for this layman to the Fisheries Committee, the term closing out, what does that exactly mean?
We, through the Chair, Representative Ortiz, we've limited a fishery, and we evolved to a point where we decided, where there are cases left before us to decide in order to, let me go back to the premise. The nature of the limitation is that we're looking backward over years of a fishery, so there are always more applicants for limited entry permits than the maximum number, which represents 1 year. So not everybody who applies can get a permit. That's where the point system comes in. So we work our way down through the point system, and as we start at the highest level, showing the most need, award permits at that level. Gradually, as we decide more cases, we can calculate how far we can lower the point scale, and what we're trying to reach is the maximum number. And so at the point we do reach the maximum number or exceed it under circumstances like I've described, that ends the process. People who are below that point level lose, and people above the point level get their permits, and we are done. From that point, the fishery goes forward, and people can transfer permits, but we're done with our part.
Thank you.
Hmm. Any further questions from this committee? I'd certainly like to thank the commissioners for coming and giving us their presentation. We will not be meeting on February 26th. We will be meeting on, the Fisheries Committee will be meeting on March 3rd in this room at 10 a.m. on House Bill 103. We will be meeting on March 5th in this room at 10 a.m. again with the CFEC, and that will be in relation to House Bill 112 and the Lawson Report. The Lawson Report can be found on the Alaska Department Fish and Game website, and the response to that by the CFEC, is that on your website? Am I correct in making that statement?
Madam Chairman, Ben Brown from CFEC. We asked Fish and Game to put it on their website as well. I'm not certain if it's there. It is most assuredly on our website under publications.
Okay, wonderful. So if there's no further business to come before this committee, I will call this committee adjourned at 11:18. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.